In the mid-1990s, only 1 in 20 patients with metastatic melanoma responded to treatment. In a Barcelona hospital, Dr. Anthony Ribas witnessed the limitations of chemotherapy and glimpsed the untapped potential of the immune system. Today, as director of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy Center at UCLA and the Tumor Immunology Program at the Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center, Dr. Ribas has helped write a new chapter in cancer care. Where once only 5% of patients responded, now half of his clinic achieves durable responses, some celebrating more than 2 decades of life after treatment. His pioneering work on checkpoint inhibitors helped establish the foundation for therapies like Keytruda, now approved for more than 40 cancer indications. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran from PICE. Today, on From Bench to Fireside, PICE's Chief Scientific Officer, Dr. John Connolly, explores the science of survival with Dr. Ribas. They'll discuss how understanding each patient's response, from checkpoint blockade to cellular therapy, drives progress, and why the PICE Network's model of fearless collaboration is accelerating the path from laboratory insight to life-saving treatment. Join us for a conversation with a pioneer who sees beyond the data to the biology behind every response on From Bench to Fireside.
I'm John Connolly, Chief Scientific Officer at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with Tony Ribas, who's been at the forefront of advancing cancer immunotherapy. Dr. Ribas is the director of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy at UCLA, the director of the Tumor Immunology Program at the Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center at UCLA, and the past president of AACR. Tony's been really instrumental in developing treatments that transform cancer care from the earliest days of immunotherapy. He's led work on the development of anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1 therapy, and these drugs are approved in over 40 indications and truly have established immunotherapy as a pillar of cancer care. He's a world leader in clinical trials and clinical trial design, principal investigator of what is considered the largest phase 1 clinical study in oncology with over 600 patients participating across 12 institutions in the U.S., Europe, and Australia. Tony is recognized globally for his pivotal role in the development of checkpoint inhibitors, understanding both the mechanism of action and mechanisms of resistance. He continues to push the field today. So today we'll explore his journey from those early days to becoming one of immunotherapy's pioneers as director of the PICE Center at UCLA. Welcome, Tony. Thanks for coming on From Bench to Fireside.
John, I'll come more frequently with an introduction as kind as this one. It's a sure. Pleasure to be here and great to talk with you about cancer immunotherapy.
That's fantastic. So where are you joining us from today?
So I'm at UCLA. I'm at in my office in Los Angeles. I have my research lab across that door and I see patients across the street.
That's fantastic. That integration between the lab and the clinic, really, it highlights, I think, one of the big keys of that UCLA center that you've built up and created with clinician scientists really shoulder to shoulder with the engineers, with basic biologists really trying to get to the heart of the matter. So you've got a long journey, you know, in your career, coming from Barcelona, Spain. How did that early life in your really shape your thoughts and your approach to cancer care?
So I started by curiosity. I finished my medical training in Barcelona, Spain. I did residency in Vall d'Hebron, which at that time was a big community hospital. Now it's a world-class research place, but it was before that. And it was in the mid-1990s where we were giving chemotherapy to patients, and sure. A majority of patients did not benefit and had side effects, and we didn't know why some patients did well and many others did not. And then there was this thing about the immune system. Every time somebody did well, someone would say, oh, it's probably the immune system kicked in. So, well, might as well study that. So in the mid-90s, I didn't even have an email. So I wrote letters with a stamp and put them in the mail to ask to go to laboratories in the U.S. that I thought were doing interesting early immunology and cancer immunology studies, and ended up here in the lab of Jim Economo, who was a surgeon. And it's been great. I came for a year or two. It's 28 years later. I haven't left.
That's fantastic. What brought you to UCLA? What was it about Jim's group and that team that he built up?
he was one of the places that answered and accepted me. There were several others. And my wife said, well, between several cities in the U.S., L.A. seemed to be more attractive. And we knew some people here, so that made it easier. But also it's this community. It's a place where I'm pretty sure I could be the same person somewhere else, and unless the level is as high, where there's so many people who are world experts, and I can go down the hall and there's a world expert there who knows how to do that. And it's been a very supportive community. I have only good things to say about the setting I work in.
That's amazing. Absolutely fantastic people. And it's an incredible team that you've built. But in those early days, when you just got there, you were doing immunotherapy in what was a bit of the wilderness of cancer care, you know? So how was that, and how was that experience? And how did that help shape your path?
I doubted myself many times.
Sure.
Every time I would go back to Spain and talk with my colleagues there, some of them would tell me, and some of them became really famous afterwards. Mm-hmm. So, you're wasting your time. The immune system will never be able to treat cancer. It's all that phenomenology. You don't know it. Well, we started knowing, and the obvious pioneer is Jim Allison. His discovery that there's this a main negative regulator to the immune system at the time of activation, CTLA-4, that could be modulated pharmacologically with an antibody. And we did one of the two phase one trials with one of them, tremelimumab. And we saw that we could treat a deadly cancer, metastatic melanoma, that at that time was among the worst of the worst. We could treat those patients, and I have had patients from this phase one trial in 2001 that have responded, continue to respond. So now we're going for close to 25 years.
It's amazing.
It gives a real hope for long-term benefit in patients with a metastatic cancer. And CTLA-4 was the founding idea, the most important one. PD-1 was the next one. It turns out that PD-1 is more important in humans than it's in mice, and CTLA-4 is more important in mice than in humans. But there's a subset of patients with multiple cancers that their immune system is stuck with this one checkpoint, PD-1, that we can block with anti-PD-1 antibodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that idea of kind of refocusing the immune system back onto, or de-repressing, in this case, the immune system, and really reactivating it, absolute positive game changer. And you were there in those early days when those first results come out. How was that in those trials when you started seeing the results from the studies, whether it's CTLA-4 or PD-1 studies?
Yeah, with CTLA-4 was a low response rate, 10 to 15%, but true responses were... We are giving an antibody we knew kills no cancer cell at all by itself. So you're infusing people a treatment that is not a cancer treatment. It's blocking a protein in on a T cell. But then the T cells would attack the cancer. And those patients have responses anywhere in the body. Fast forward 10 years, when we did the phase one trial of pembrolizumab, what became Keytruda, I selected patients. By then, we had learned a little bit that patients with more chronic sun exposure, probably more mutated melanomas, would be more likely to respond. So we entered the first 7 patients with melanoma in the clinical trial. 6 of them responded. I went to my colleague, John Glaspie, and I said, John, I may need another cancer to work on pretty soon. Unfortunately, it was not that. The response rate at the end was, when we didn't select as well, was around 40%, still remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
But patients are continuing to respond from that time. That's 2011 when we started, and I have clinic this afternoon, and I probably will see 1 or 2 from the early trials.
That's phenomenal. And we love that 40% response rate. It's really solid. And obviously also across multiple tumor types as well. And I think that, you know, your work and the work of many other immunotherapists is really driven down to understand which patients would respond and which patients don't, based on things like, you know, hot tumors and mutational burden and all of these different factors. But, you know, there's another 60% that's not responding. So getting to that question of, you've got a wonderful drug. Everybody seems to have a good competent, many of them have a good competent immune system. What is it that's missing so that we can't really push the frontier of these checkpoint inhibitors to really impact more patients?
Yeah, but responses to immune checkpoint blockade, the premise is that everything worked on the immune system, that the cancer was immunogenic, that the immune system recognized the cancer, that it was trying, and then the cancer was protecting itself by expressing one of the ligands of the immune checkpoints.
Yeah.
So it's like aligning 50 stars, and if there's only one star off, you can try to correct that. If there's multiple off, if the cancer is not immunogenic, if the immune system of that patient for whatever reason does not recognize the cancer, then you cannot fix it by taking away checkpoints. We've gotten here by following the science. It was first the phenomenology. It may be the immune system why a patient responded. Then it was to start to understand what are the rules of the game and what are the main limitations of an immune response to cancer, hence CTLA-4 and PD-1. Now we have to get to the next steps, which is in this, the percentage of patients who do not benefit by taking away one of these checkpoints, what should we do? And John, you and I have talked a lot about cellular therapies, and I think that is the next frontier where in the patients where the immune system endogenously is not attacking the cancer, we can take those immune system cells out and reprogram them to attack, to recognize and attack the cancer. Not an easy thing to do, but a feasible way to address these patients that do not benefit from immune checkpoint blockade.
Is there a cell therapy, Tony, that you're most excited about that's out there?
Well, the key thing of a cell therapy is what does it recognize in the cancer? And the main thing is it has to be something that's in the cancer, not in the normal cells.
Right.
And it turns out there's not that many of those markers. You can do it personalized by looking at mutations that are in the cancer and not in normal cells. And we tried to do that with Jim Heath and David Baltimore. We even created a company, put a quarter of $1 billion into it, and we did it, but it was not good enough, and mm-hmm. needed another quarter of $1 billion to get to being therapeutic. And in this market, it was difficult to do that. But it tells us that it can be done, that there's no scientific barriers. There's mostly effort and focus and economic barriers. The Pisces are looking at the opportunities of if we have science that we can bring back to patients, we should mm-hmm. empower it and bring the right people together, the scientists, the investors, the professionals who know how to do cell therapies. And I think by doing that, we'll find feasible and sustainable ways to treat cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. But as you said, it all goes back to the science, going back to those patients, deeply understanding kind of those mechanisms of resistance, and then designing those therapies to address those mechanisms. And I think that that TCR kind of space is, these are the antigens that the immune system really sees, you know, in real life, you know, and it'd be wonderful. It is wonderful to start to see some good results from clinical trials in the TCR space. One of the things that you were really pushing and pioneering again is thinking about how the immune system, again, really works with TCRs. And what a real immune response is not against a single target, it's against multiple targets simultaneously. How's your work kind of led to your thoughts on multiplex kind of targeting and targeting multiple things within a cell therapy clinical trial?
Cancer is an amazing group of diseases where if we block one thing, they try to find a way to go around it. And we know that from targeted therapies and the very elegant science of making drugs specific for specific mutations in cancer. We get responses, but then the cancer finds a way around it. With the immune system, it has more trouble. So the majority of patients who respond to immune checkpoint blockade respond long-term. It's probably a polyclonal response. There's multiple clones of T cells that recognize the cancer. And with Chris Puchaus and Jim Heath, we have studied that, and we do see that the patients who respond to a PD-1 immunotherapy have multiple clones of T cells with multiple TCRs to the same immunodominant mutations. To recapitulate that, it takes a lot of effort. There's trade-offs. There's all the whole field of chimeric antigen receptors of CARs that's so successful in lymphomas and leukemias and multiple myeloma. It's been less in cancers, but in solid cancers, mostly because we haven't found the right targets. But probably we find a good target and we get a very super physiological immune response, even if it's one target, I think we can still succeed.
It's just as long as there's a heterogeneity within that tumor and the target's really there, and it's a great target. So there's another aspect of the immune response, which is kind of that innate immune response as well. When we go back to trying to recapitulate the full immunity cycle, how do you, what are your thoughts there on kind of innate activators, things like oncolytic viruses and things like that, that may really prepare the tumor to initiate anti-tumor immunity?
Yeah, one of our premises is that the cancer at some point needs to be helping the immune system to treat the cancer. And we know this indirectly because the few patients who have a response to PD-1 blockade and progress, which around 10 to 15%, luckily it's low. Whenever they progress, there's two genetic changes that we found in several cases. One of them is they stop expressing the antigen-presenting machinery, and mostly beta 2 microglobulin. The other one is that they knock out the genes that signal through the interferon receptor. And if we think about it, those are the two main sites of interaction between a T cell and the cancer, besides the killing mechanisms. And whenever a T cell recognizes a cancer through the T cell receptor, it makes interferon. And that forces the cancer cell to turn on 600 genes within 6 hours and 2,000 genes within 24 hours. It's a major change in the cancer. And it turns out that the majority of cancers have interferon gamma receptors. Beats me why. There's very few cells that make interferon gamma, T cells and activated NK cells. But the cancers do have, the cancers in most tissues have interferon response ability. So that changes the cancer and makes it more visible to the immune system and a better target. So one of our concepts that turns the cancer cells as enablers of the immune response, because otherwise the cancer is a very unfriendly place for T cells. It has the wrong pH, it has the wrong set of cells. If you culture T cells in that environment, they don't like it. But if you start making 2,000 interferon response genes, then they like it. So the key thing is that we have to prepare that tumor microenvironment to be more friendly to T cells. And the different ways to do it, it could be infected with an oncolytic virus. It could be a TLR agonist. There are several ways where you could change and turn into an interferon-friendly environment, and then T cells can thrive.
Sure. And so people have tried this a little bit with TLR agonists. We talked about, I know there's been some TLR9 checkpoint combinations and things like that. And they haven't really seen that, what we really want to see. So what's the missing link? And it seems like you've got, from an immunology standpoint, you've got the innate immune response triggered. You've got an existing adaptive immune response that can kind of pick this up. What are the next cycles that you think we need to overcome to really get this moving in solid tumors? I mean, really the big challenge in the field.
So we've done clinical trials where with patients who had metastatic melanoma that were progressing on anti-PD-1, we started injecting intratumorally a TLR agonist or an oncolytic virus. And in a subset of patients, around a third, we can reverse the resistance by doing this and continuing with anti-PD-1. That addresses one of the problems. It does not address the other major problem, which is the cancers that are not immunogenic or not recognized by the immune system. So it is a contribution. It is something that could improve. The thing is that when you do it up front, it's harder to demonstrate that benefit. In randomized trials, the benefit has been small, and you need a lot of patients to show that it's statistically significant, which is beyond the purpose of why we do clinical trials. We want to have something that has a large marginal of benefit.
And so that's one of those things that I think it goes back to what you said before. All the stars have to align, not three or four of them. Like you really to get the whole cycle going. It's tremendously exciting. I think that your work in the field, not just from the discussion right now, not just in trying to take this into the clinic and really benefit patients, but to deeply understand what you're doing. You know, what is it that's happening in these patients? You're really pioneering a number of different technologies and work in the spatial, deep understanding of the tumor microenvironment, all the way from combinations of things like checkpoint to oncolytic viruses. And so One thing that I think that's important about the Parker Institute and is really this idea of multi-institutional collaborations and expertise all brought around this one big problem. So, you know, you've been involved in the Parker Institute from the very beginning. And so what makes PICES model so effective and what are the advantages you see to that?
Well, if you bring the best of the best together every 6 months and every 6 months they show up wanting to share their latest data and their latest breakthroughs, it's hard to find a community like this, a research community. It's created a different kind of thinking. These are, we talk about team science. This is beyond team science. This is field science, where a whole field of researchers that before they were working on their projects and being not sharing their latest data because they wanted to publish it. Now it's more important for all of us to present it at a PICES meeting and get the input of our colleagues than having a publication in Nature or Science. And I think we would all agree that this is the impact in the field is by elevating it all and being brought up because you know more. There's a common goal. We all believe that the immune system can treat cancer, and we're doing it in different ways and looking for the limitations. The patients who respond, it's not luck. This patient was lucky. We gave this treatment and the patient responded. Well, it's not luck. It's biology. And if we don't figure it out, it's on us. We have to know why that happened. And if a patient responds and progresses, that's not bad luck. That is biology that happened. And if we understand it, we can intervene and prevent that from happening to other patients.
Yeah, absolutely. This is well said. And I think that one of the things that I've seen is that everyone, whether you're a pure molecular biologist or an informatician or whatever it is, everyone is mission focused on really translating that to the patients. And in order to do that, you really do need this team-based approach that you and the UCLA team have really demonstrated so well. When you think about this in terms of individual projects, what are the big projects that you've run that you think that came out of this network effect?
We started 20 years ago, learning from Steve Rosenberg how to genetically modify T cells by putting T cell receptors. We started with the receptor to MART and then NY-ESO that he had cloned. And by learning how to do that, we created a community here. We called the Engineered Immunity Community with led initially by David Baltimore and Owen Weary. Mm-hmm. And we've been meeting at the beginning, we meet every couple of months at Caltech or UCLA and then once a year in a place in the mountains called Arrowhead that you, John, have come lately.
That's
because we turned that group into the PICES group because most of them became PICES members. Those early experiences allowed us to know that you could clinically intervene with just two technicians and a lab that was a clean room where you would pipette cells and modify their genes and give them back to patients. Knowing how to do that, that led to one of the most successful cell therapy companies, Kite Pharma, which started with a founders from UCLA, and they were looking for some immunotherapy to do. And so, the CD19 CARs learned about the first response from Jim Kutchendorfer and Steve Rosenberg, and then Kyle June's three patients with a response right after, with doing it slightly differently. For example, that is what we're going to do. And we build the team to do it commercially and then bring it up. It's really eye-opening to think that something that it's a small laboratory project with two technicians allows you to learn how to take what the field has created, which is C19 CARs, and run with it, do it commercially and benefit any patient with those cancers.
Yeah, this is key. That, you know, you mentioned the formation of Kite and some of these other companies. They do play a really important role in scaling this for the entire ecosystem. And it's amazing to have a real impact on a single patient, just absolutely life-changing. But to make that available to everybody, to really get it out there is just an essential part of that mission. You know, you're in the melanoma space. I mean, this has always been at the forefront of immunology, going back to IL-2, to vaccines, to you name it. But we have had some high-profile cases. President Carter is a great example in the melanoma space. How has that impacted the ability to kind of tell a story to the greater community out there and to talk about what immunotherapy really means?
Well, let's take the example of President Carter. I did not treat him, but he received pembrolizumab Keytruda for a metastatic melanoma to the liver and to the brain. He was 94 or 95 when that happened. He was very public about it. Now he turned 100. President Carter will not die from metastatic melanoma to the brain and to the liver. He'll die from older age, which makes you pause and say, well, we have to start talking about cures. And we're reluctant because occasionally a patient that we thought was doing well long-term relapses. I've seen that. I've seen it 10 years later, unfortunately. So I have trouble using the word cure, but I know a subset of patients who come to my clinic and I do a scan every year because they're years out of having metastatic melanoma, they're probably cured. And we talk about this. It's changed how we think about cancer. When we first started having patients with long-term benefit, we started talking about things like, do I get life insurance? What do I do with my trust? Do I modify it again? Now I have grandchildren. Can I go out and live somewhere else that's farther away from where I'm being treated? It changed how we think about cancer by turning on a system, the immune system, that has the ability to give long-term responses, because the immune system remembers. And once it attacks cancer and does it well, it continues to do so for years.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And you know, it's actually amazing that President Carter's response, even at that age, it says something about that the immune system is still there. You know what I mean? It's such an essential, important part of every day. And then refocusing back and licensing it really to attack that cancer is just an enormous, enormous step. And you deal a lot with patients in the SWOG, the Southwest Oncology Group. This is another area of patient interface. How has that kind of changed the way that you're interacting, and how has that become a real resource for you?
I'm very supportive of the work of the National Cancer Institute in implementing multi-center clinical trials. It is a hard thing to get a whole bunch of people to agree, this is the clinical trial we should do.
Yeah.
And I have the National Cancer Institute investigators, the melanoma investigators, and the reviewers of the melanoma investigators, and say, you do this clinical trial, which if you do this clinical trial, you cannot do these other clinical trials. So the time that I was there, we said, we're going to follow the science. If we think that patients who respond to anti-PD-1s because they had pre-existing T cells, we'll look at the cancer that has that. And there's one uncommon melanoma called desmoplastic melanoma that had T cells there and a lot of mutations. Used to be the worst of the worst. We give them anti-PD-1, we have an 89% response rate.
Wow.
We treated in this comparative group 55 patients, either locally advanced or metastatic. At 3 years, only one patient has died from melanoma. There's been 8 other patients who died. They died from other causes. This becomes no longer a surgical disease. It used to be a disease where they would resect and re-resect and do radiation because it would come back locally and then would become metastatic. We changed the course of it by turning on the immune system. But then there's the other aspect, the patients who do not respond to anti-PD-1 who have metastatic melanoma. Well, if we give anti-PD-1 alone, we're only blocking one checkpoint. So we thought, well, let's add anti-CTLA-4 at the time of progression. We avoid the potential of side effects up front, the patients who respond to anti-PD-1, they do not need two therapies. But the ones who don't come with reverse resistance and reactivate T cells that are stuck in an earlier checkpoint, CTLA-4. And actually, by doing that, we had a 30% response rate in this primary resistance situation. So it's a kind of thing where you had to be able to say, we're doing this clinical trial for these reasons, and here's the science that supports it.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about going out there and actually going after tumors that you 100% know are going to be, that have all the criteria? We've got a bit of a fingerprint now. Things like desmoplastic melanoma or Merkel cell carcinoma and other areas. Should there be more effort in these kind of smaller cancers that are more responsive to really try to get to a point where we're truly changing clinical care?
Yeah, we can cite the work of Luis Diaz and Andrea Cercek in Memorial Sloan Kettering on microsatellite unstable colon cancers, where the patients with rectal cancers, they would get surgery and reconstruct the rectum and then would get immunotherapies. And they said, well, let's do, before the surgery, let's give anti-PD-1. Yeah. And they had 100% response rate. And 6 months later, none of the patients went to have surgery because they had 100% response rate. And years later, they're still not needing the surgery and responding. So in these exceptional responder indications, we have to change the pattern of care. And that should be for everybody, everywhere. There's limitations to that because the information does not get to everybody that treats these patients. The FDA approval process for indications requires certain clinical trials, and in rare cancers, you cannot do that. And then once you know the data, you cannot go back and randomize patients. Right. I would never randomize patients to have surgery when they can. And the same with desmoplastic melanoma, we find ourselves, well, that's no longer, it has equipoise to do that. So it's more about disseminating information and being able to get it to the people who treat this.
And this has really been part of your role when you were past president of AACR, these professional societies really getting out there and educating physicians and you know, physician networks to really begin to change care.
I fully agree.
What do you see now with the patients that are being treated now? Where in the therapies that are out there? What do you see for cancer immunotherapy in the next 10 years?
I think we'll get to a point where we'll have maxed out our ability to unleash checkpoints, and probably there with the combinations that we've done and try to. So there's where, as we said before, the next frontier would be to engineer the immune system and effectively to attack cancer. But the progress has been remarkable. When I started treating melanoma 20, 25 years ago, 1 in 20 patients and most had a response, and those were unlikely to be durable responses. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, the patient was lucky, had an immune response. Now, half of the patients in my clinic are having a durable response. Wow. And that's by sequencing and combining these different immunotherapies that we have approved and then the targeted therapies. So it's a remarkable change that I benefited from living through in my academic life.
It really is building upon a lot of the science that you've discovered and you've worked on. In the next 10 years, all of that will be applied, as you said, into the cell therapy, the synthetic immunology, where we begin to really take that deep understanding and move forward. And again, speaks to the diversity of expertise and the teams that you bring together. Some of those people, of course, are mentees of yours that you're mentoring and bringing up and trying to guide. So you were mentored early in your career, as you mentioned, Jim, and the entire team there at UCLA and then back in Spain. But what are the qualities that you're looking for in people that you want to mentor? What are you trying to instill in them to really make it successful and make a real dent in cancer?
I think it's the overall focus. There has to be a drive from inside that we're going to we want to learn things that are important and can benefit patients.
Yeah.
Whenever I've interviewed somebody and says, "Oh, I would like to come to your lab. I'm interested in publishing a paper in Nature Science." Don't come. I don't want that mentality. The mentality we want is that we work on important questions. We understand the biology, and we think, how can that biology help patients? And if we do that, then we should publish it on the best place possible if it's impactful. And if it's not, then we publish somewhere else. It doesn't really matter. It's the advancement of the science that's important. So that's what I see in the people that I mentor. And the rest has to come from inside. You have to be passionate about this work, and you have to be passionate about wanting to do better. We go many times into the unknown. We do new things that are hard because we think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's well said. I think it's that passion has to drive you completely. But I like the idea of just focus on the patients. You know, everything else follows behind that kind of success. And it's one thing that's characterized you in your entire career, Tony. So if you hadn't pursued a career in medicine and science, what is it that you would do? I ask everybody that question.
I have a lot of other interests.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. I don't know. I like art. I like cooking. I like sports and sure. Jogging. I wish I had more time for reading. I find myself reading a lot of scientific articles instead of books. I think someday I'll retire. Maybe 20 years from now. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to keep us busy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fantastic. So Tony, for our listeners, interested in clinical trials, interested in research opportunities, and interested in what's next coming out of your lab, what's the best way to learn more about the science that's happening there at the UCLA Center?
Well, for patients, we try to understand their disease, and if we cannot adapt clinical trials to patients or patients to clinical trials, we have to find the right matches and at the right time. So we do spend time on learning about the disease and having a portfolio of clinical trials that we hope can address at least test hypotheses in settings that currently have no good treatments. For trainees and investigators, the importance is to understand why things happen. And once you understand that, then you can make a change. And full-time clinicians are really good at what they do. They understand what happens in patients, and we really need that. Laboratory researchers, they understand model systems, and they say, well, if we do this, this is what happens. So maybe we could try this in humans. So I think it's a community that comes together by bringing expertise from multiple sides and elevating the game from everyone with the goal of treating patients better.
Once again, a huge thanks to you, legendary Tony Rivas here, director of the Pisces Center at UCLA, for joining us today and sharing your insights, your journey, and your views on what's next in this incredibly exciting field. So thank you again for another great discussion on From Bench to Fireside.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to From Bench to Fireside from the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, where Dr. Anthony Rebus revealed how understanding mechanisms of response is advancing cancer care. Through PICE, Dr. Rebus found a new way to accelerate discovery, where the world's leading researchers convene at scientific retreats to share breakthroughs, where impact matters more than publication, and where collaboration drives the science that changes patients' lives. To learn more about PICE and stay up to speed on the latest discoveries, join our newsletter by visiting www.parkerici.org. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran. Join us next time on From Bench to Fireside.